The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present the first in this series of 15 literary dialogues on love, human and divine, featuring two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Professor Mark Van Doren.
Maurice, we have for our topic in this summer series a topic of the greatest richness and depth for me, and I'm sure for you. Love, human, and divine. The reference, of course, always being the Hebrew Bible, which will be the source and fountain of all the examples that we shall treat in connection with this topic. The reason that the topic interests me so much, or at least one reason that it does, is the erroneous notion about the Hebrew Bible in many people's minds today, that it is a book largely characterized by bitterness and gloom, wrath and vengeance, as if it were not a loving book. Whereas for me, it is a book drenched with love. And I hope that you will agree with me that many, many opportunities will arise for us to prove that this is true, and nothing will give me greater pleasure than to do so.
I think that that observation is correct, this erroneous notion, as you call it, and very likely some of it is traceable to a misunderstanding of what people have called God's arbitrariness in choosing the Jewish people, as they call it. You know that jingle that exists, "How odd of God to choose the Jews," to which a Jew replied, "Oh, no, it's not. God knows what's what."
Yeah.
That's putting it on a rather jocular level. But it does indicate the source of a misunderstanding as to God's intentions toward man.
Well, I'm not sure, Maurice, that the difficulty arises just there, or that the impression is created just there. God's choosing of the Jews could seem to be the story of a choice which was followed on his part always by indulgence, if not flattery, of the chosen. Whereas, of course, it is true that he's often angry with his people and judges them and punishes them and is often said to be quite properly, a God of jealousy and a God of wrath, even though he's also called a God of mercy and a God of loving kindness. My point would be that a great many readers, or they're not readers, I don't think they read the Bible, or they wouldn't say what they say. A great many of them remember only the judgment and the wrath, and do not remember the mercy and the loving kindness.
Yes, but they also don't remember that what was called a choice was a sort of, if I may put it in this way, a natural development, because the very first man whom he chose, as it were, was a man who, according to the tradition, obeyed my laws, my statutes, and my commandments. Now, notice, the Jews were not, Abram was not the discoverer of monotheism. Even the Hebrew Bible tells us that. We read in the fourth chapter of Genesis that in that day, long before Abraham, men began to call upon the name of the Lord.
Yeah.
It wasn't that he first glimpsed the idea of God, but that he obeyed the laws, statutes, and commandments. In other words, he was, in the religious sense, according to the tradition, the first civilized man. And God saw there the possibility of the continuity through the patriarchs. And then he tells us in Deuteronomy through Moses that I chose you because of the forefathers. And it isn't that arbitrariness which has frequently been attributed to God as conceived in the Hebrew Bible. But then, as you say, there seem to be these alternations, the indulgence and the punishment, indulgence and punishment, as though there were a long, one might call it an affair between the two in which they couldn't get along. You know, sometimes I thought of an inverted parody, you know, a parody in reverse. You take something that's lighthearted or flippant and turn it into something serious. You know, the movies, they have the formula for a story. Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy finds girl.
Yes.
That's the story. That's the basis of a good movie. Well, then, this basis of man's relationship is God, man finds God, man loses God, man finds God.
Yes.
That is the recurrent story, with installments apparently reaching on into eternity.
And, of course, this notion of a lover's quarrel between God and his people is a notion that anyone can understand at any time, since all love relations, no matter what they are, no matter how individual they are, or how peculiar, or how local, how even eccentric they are probably include quarreling and misunderstanding and making up and rediscovery. You may remember that Robert Frost said in one of his poems, "I have a lover's quarrel with the world."
Yes.
I have a lover's quarrel with the world.
Beautiful phrase.
Meaning that the world for him is alternately right and wrong. And he is right and wrong with reference to it. In other words, he's always falling out of love with it and then falling in love with it again. Now, this alternation, which I suppose comes to a kind of climax, at any rate, as far as explicitness of statement is concerned, in the book of Judges, this alternation is extremely interesting, and I only want to say once more that I pity those people who remember only the dark half of it. You remember in Judges, we are told that for a long period of time, after the people had come to the promised land, and long before Samuel and David brought the people to their glory, during a period that I suppose could have been centuries, God alternately blessed and punished his people. For a generation or two generations, they would live at rest. They'd live at peace with him. They remembered him, they loved him, and they kept his commandments. But then they would fall away. They would forget him, as it were. And then he punished them by letting their heathen neighbors, usually the Philistines, smite them. And so for a generation or two, they would be smitten. But then someone would appear, someone would arise among them to be a judge, that is to say, to be one who could remind them of their great heritage and of their duty and of their love, remind them of all that, and back would come their rest and their peace. That alternation, which always leaves with me the image of a sea with waves in it, with rather violent waves, that for the time being becomes...
Well, that's a very good image.
Disappear.
The Hebrew Bible is a tumultuous book.
That's right.
It's filled with anguish. It is the record of a great wrestling of a people with itself. And what I would like to observe again is that throughout, this special relationship between God and the Jewish people is not exclusive of God's care for the rest of the world. Again and again, we are reminded, both in the Bible and in the comments which have arisen on it, that his care for other peoples is continuous. When he talks of the stranger, he says, "Thou shalt love the stranger." Or, "God loves the stranger in that he takes care for his nourishment." The prophets were often sent to other peoples to rebuke them, as in the case of Jonah going to Nineveh, in case of the prophecies of Jeremiah regarding the surrounding peoples. But it is made to appear, or it appears, that there was a special aptitude in the Jews for receiving this kind of instruction of what you've called alternating indulgence and punishment. And often I've thought that it took the Jews so long to become a faithful people. They didn't become a faithful people until they'd actually been thrown out of their country.
Yes.
You know, I've often thought the Jews never believed God, that he was going to throw them out of their country.
Mm.
And the traumatic effect of being actually thrown out and sent into Babylon, it's as though the people said, "Look, he went and did it after all." Mm-hmm. They never believed he would do it, because it went on for 1,000 years and they were still in the country. They were oppressed in the country, and then all of a sudden he did it. And that is what brought about the great change. One can say that the record of the Bible is the record of the people struggling to accept the idea. After that, one may say of the Jewish people as a whole, in spite of partial defections, that it continued in firmness. Now, what has often bothered me is, it must be a terribly hard thing for a people, it was a terribly hard thing for a people to get used to the notion of God's overwhelming love.
Yes.
This love isn't at all like a human thing. Do you know, it sometimes occurs to me that it's like a benevolent 1984.
Mm.
God watches you. He is the Bochin Levavot. He examines the hearts. He looks into the thoughts of man. He sees his secret heart. And man doesn't know where to escape.
Yes, and of course, there's the curious fact that God loves men not only collectively, but individually. He not only loves man or mankind, and I quite agree with you, it's proper to say that means all men everywhere, but he loves every man. That means that every man carries this burden also of knowledge that God loves him. The knowledge that God loves him,
yes, well,
is a very deep and could be a disturbing kind of knowledge, because I say disturbing only in this sense, that it causes thoughts to rise and causes feelings to be had, which are extraordinary, to say the least.
Well, if one takes it literally, a man feels he's being watched all the time, that even his dreams are subject to that kind of observation.
And, of course, the thing that impressed the Jews so much in the old days was God's constantly telling them that he himself was invisible. He said, you have never seen me. To be sure, I spoke with Abraham. Abraham heard my voice. And Moses saw me just in a flesh, just a part of me once on Sinai. But I am, for the most part, invisible. You saw the fire out of which I spoke. Yes, that's true. But I am in the sky. I am in heaven. I am elsewhere than where you are. That, of course, is a tremendous fact. He was not there could be no image of him. He was not an image. He was not a thing, not a person. Of course, in some very great sense, he was a person. He was the person. But they could not see him. They had to believe in him. The reason, maybe, that makes sense to say that they had to believe in him was simply that they could not see him. God remained always invisible. But the pressure from him was all the greater for that.
When you talked before, Mark, of the misunderstanding as to the predominance of wrath and vengeance and sternness in Hebrew Bible, it occurred to me there's a very fine comment made on the passage which is very often quoted in that connection. For I, the Lord thy God, I'm a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children, upon the third and on the fourth generation of those that hate me, and showing mercy unto the thousandth generations of those that love me and keep holy my commandments. Now, if one wanted to be pedantic and arithmetical, one would set off these two figures, that he punishes unto the fourth generation, and the other, it says, thousands. Noseh chesed le'alafim is the Hebrew phrase, thousands of generations, so it's a proportion of 4 to a minimum of 2,000.
Yes.
That is the proportion of wrath to love and grace.
And that ratio is what I lament to see is not remembered. You agree that that might very well put it in terms of arithmetic for us. The loving kindness of God is thousands of times greater and more lasting than his wrath. Although, to be sure, his wrath and his punishments are severe and terrible, graphically described, and we are bound to remember them. It is simply a pity for me that we do not remember the others. You interested me a minute ago, Maurice, when you talked about his noticing the first of his people, the first of those people who were going to be his people, namely Abraham. And we have talked about this in other summers. I'd like to come back to it again. You have introduced the topic, but let me take it up for a minute. God's noticing Abraham, God's seeing him way off there in the distance, east of the country that he was eventually to come to, Todd, seeing him there is to me a tremendous event. It's as if God said to himself, among all the men that live and creep upon the surface of the earth, there is one to whom I can say certain things that I believe he will understand. Furthermore, I believe in him. I believe in his capacity to transmit what I tell him to those about him and those who will come out of him, his descendants. And God never ceases to remind the people that that had happened. You're quite right. On more than one occasion, I believe we particularly hear about this in the book of Deuteronomy.
Yes.
He has Moses tell the people that God's original love was for the patriarchs.
Yes.
Was for
a few men. Not because you're great and not because you're strong. There are many greater and stronger peoples, but I chose you because of the transmission, as you've called it, Mark, that has come through you.
Now, I might say, Maurice, that at that point, and I hope I'm not straining any point here, at that point, I believe what he saw in Abraham was, among other things, a capacity for love. Now, I'm using that word in spite of the fact that the word is not used in the Hebrew Bible of Abraham himself. But I believe that God saw in him the power to not only love God himself and love his word, that is to say, thoroughly understand it, because love and understanding are very closely connected, but the power to love others, his wife and his son and his people, the power to love others in the sense that he could trust them to understand. Because Abraham's calling was not only to be called, but to call, to remind others of this immense event that had occurred, namely the speaking to him in his own ear of God's voice.
I think you know, Mark, that when a proselyte came to the Jews and he had to be given a new name, it was usually Abraham.
No, I didn't know that.
To signalize precisely that event, a repetition of that first calling up or covenant or treaty between man and God. I'm rather interested to emphasize that source of misunderstanding, as I called it, that this exclusiveness has been wrongly assessed. I was reading Maimonides and came across a passage in which a proselyte is given advice as to how he ought to pray. And this is an interesting side commentary on another misunderstanding, a very bitter one, the accusation of racialism that has been leveled against the Tanakh, against the Hebrew Bible, and against the Jewish outlook. Let me read this, Mark.
Yes, I'd like to hear
it. The letter of Maimonides regarding a non-Jew had become a Jew, and this is how it goes. I received the question of the wise scholar Obadiah the proselyte. Apparently this one hadn't taken the name of Abraham. You ask whether, being a proselyte, you should utter the prayers, "Our God and the God of our fathers, who has separated us from the nations, who has brought us out of Egypt. Pronounce all prayers as they are written and do not change anything. Your prayer and blessing should be the same as that of any other Israelite, regardless of whether you pray in private or conduct the service." The explanation is as follows. Abraham, our father, taught mankind the true belief and the unity of God, repudiating the idolatry. Through him, many of his household and others also were guided to keep the way of the Lord. Thus, he who becomes a proselyte and confesses the unity of God as taught in the Torah is a disciple of Abraham, our father, and such persons are of his household. Just as Abraham influenced his contemporaries through his word and teaching, so he leads to belief all future generations through the testament he gave to his children and his household. In this sense, Abraham is the father of his descendants who follow his ways, and his disciples, and of all the proselytes. You should therefore pray, "Our God and God of our fathers, for Abraham is also your father." And then he adds this rather touching remark, "Do not think little of your origin. We are descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but your descent is from the Creator." You see, at the same time, he broadens it out to include all mankind. And this is Maimonides, the rationalist.
Yes, I'm terribly interested in that. I didn't know the passage. I'm reminded by his reference to the Creator as the source of all being. I'm reminded of the possibility that the very first act in the Bible, the very first event in the Bible, namely the creation of the world and the creation of man in it, was an act of love. I don't know why we shouldn't say so. Don't know why we shouldn't think so. There's the very old question, why God created the world, why he troubled to do so. It was going to cause him trouble, and we know it did. We cause him trouble all the time. We trouble him. We disturb him. He grieves over us. He is afflicted by us.
Yes, there's that strange and beautiful passage in Isaiah, I think it is, in their affliction he was afflicted.
Yes.
He suffers with mankind.
Yes,
in this case he suffers with his people, but yes, he suffers with mankind.
Yes, but there again we have it. The act of creation was a complete act. Because we were, and I say we, meaning all mankind, we were created free, of course, to love him and to continue to love him, but free also not to love him for a while and to forget him, as we so often have. He created us in that sense. I'm reminded of a recent discussion that I read somewhere of a lack that is in most novels, most pieces of fiction. A statement was made by the critic in question that most novelists do not love their characters. And he went on to say that he meant by that, not, of course, that they should be sentimental about the characters, that they should favor them always.
I know what you mean. Charlemagne once made the remark to me about another novelist.
What did he say?
He said that he doesn't describe his characters, he spies on them.
That's right. Whereas a great novelist, no matter in what language he writes or at what time of the world he writes, and history has nothing to do with this, a great novelist loves his characters in the sense that he leaves them free, that they have powers within themselves which he respects, powers even to make terrible errors, and powers even to be worse than they are at times, and then better than they are at times. But it's as if the characters themselves make this determination. Isn't your impression when you're reading any first-rate story that the people are somehow free of the storyteller? They seem to make up their own minds. They seem to do what they will.
Yes, they have a certain solidity, or density of being.
Density is a good word.
That the writer cannot affect. He can turn them for you to observe, to like, but he doesn't remold them. They were there before he put them into the book.
And they continue after
he's finished the book.
And, by the way,
is one of the characteristics of biblical characters.
Exactly.
They're there. Nobody invented them, as it were.
Yes.
They were put into the scene, and they act out their parts. And that, by the way, is a reflection of the loving Creator. You remember Michelangelo's famous remark that you don't make a statue, you just cut away the marble which surrounds the statue, and there's your statue. Now, that is the feeling that you get about biblical characters. Loving it, you see it, you remove all that is superfluous, and there the character is. When you talked before about the I called it the almost oppressive love of a God for man, something that you can't flee from. There is that famous passage in Exodus where God, speaking through Moses, tells the people that when they lend money to the poor, they shouldn't take interest, shouldn't act as a usurer. And if they do happen to take a pledge from a man, say his coat, then in the evening, his cloak, they've got to return it. And then follows that poignant observation where God seems to be expostulating. He said, thou shalt return it to him by nightfall, for that is his covering, wherein shall he sleep? And it will come to pass, if he will cry to me, I will hear him, for I am gracious. Now, this intimacy that a man is directly linked to God. No courts, no social protection is half as powerful in his mind as this consolation. But it has its reverse side when one doesn't want to be loved so much. Human beings can't stand so much love. Possibly they run away from it because the burden of it, the sheer weight of care and intimate concern about what the human being is more than the human being can stand. And he complains in the Psalms. He said, if I take the wings of the morning, or if I descend into the nethermost depths of the sea, thou art there. Well, sometimes you want to get away from him, and you feel that you can't.
And yet, Maurice, the knowledge that one was not loved, and never would be loved, surely would be still more dreadful, wouldn't it?
Of course, but human beings don't reflect that way. The human beings are impulsive, act on short-range considerations. You know, if we acted on serious long-range considerations, our lives would be very different. There's a very commonplace and now widespread observation. We are told, and many of us believe, that smoking cigarettes shortens our lives. And we go on smoking.
Yeah.
Now, just imagine, if with regard to this immediate love that we have of our bodies and our health, we are neglectful of the most obvious warning, then how about the eternity that we conceive of as being our portion, the relationship to the universe and to God, how much remoter that is? To me, the astonishing thing is not that human beings are so bad, but that they have these fits of goodness, which is the demonstration of God's love for man.
Yes, and those fits of goodness, I would call fits of remembering, fits of being able to remember that love exists and that love is directed to them or to us. The person who cannot believe in love, the person who does not think it exists, is the true cynic. The Greeks, by cynic, meant, I believe, a man who did not believe that virtue exists, that it's only pretense, that it's only a fiction, and that people get advantage out of pretending it exists and acting as if it did, whereas it doesn't. But I would extend the notion still further and say that a cynic was a person who believed that love did not exist. George Santayana, the philosopher, remarked once in a little essay on love, not to believe in love is a great sign of dullness.
Profound stupidity.
Yes, a stupidity. Yes, whereas the person to whom he's referring to might very well think that he was very bright and sharp. He said, I know there's no such thing as that. People just talk about it.
You know, I know of people who take pleasure in reflecting that when a cat licks its kittens, it's purely a chemical attraction on the fur of the kitten for a chemical substance on the tongue of the cat, and then they finish up by saying, mother love is merely an extension of that and nothing more. That's the kind of person you're referring to.
And they talk as if they knew that was true. I shall always remember two little lines from Evelyn Dickinson I saw the other day. That love is all there is all we know of love.
Just heard The Words We Live By, the first in the 15-week Eternal Light summer series. Be with us again next week when Maurice Samuel and Professor Mark Van Doren will resume their discussion of love, human and divine. The Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation. Next, Monitor News on the Hour on NBC Radio.